Hello and welcome to The Reset, a mental health podcast without all the bollocks. I'm Sam Delaney. My guest this week is Katie Giorgio of the Sound Effects podcast. Katie is a practicing psychotherapist and also a huge music lover who brings the two subjects together beautifully on a fascinating pod. I've always been interested in the crossover of these two subjects myself. Music's played a huge role in my own mental health. Mostly, it's been good, but as I discussed with Katie in this episode, one of the biggest signs that I'm starting to struggle with my mood is when I stop being able to listen to music. Katie's investigated all the different angles on the role music plays in our minds and in our mood, so I was very excited to discuss it all with her in a bit of depth. I hope you enjoy listening to our chat. Katerina, welcome to The Reset.
Hi, Sam. How are you doing?
Really, really well. Thanks so much for sparing the time to talk to me today. I'm a fan of your Sound Effects podcast, and it's a subject that I'm really, really interested in, is the relationship between music and mental health. I've always wanted to cover that in some depth on The Reset, and I don't think I've really had an opportunity to do that. So I'm so happy that you agreed to come on. How did the podcast start?
Well, I started it in 2017. It's quite a complicated answer for how it started, but I guess it's a combination of things, because it was the interest in music and the interest in mental health, and then how the two things collided in my career. So when I was obviously very young, when I was a teenager, I've got an older brother, and he was really into music. He was in bands. So I was very used to, as a teenager, my brother coming home with his guitars and his friends coming around, and they were always like recording stuff and playing. And something I noticed, I was only 13 or 14 at the time. Obviously, it was around the time of Britpop. They were sort of into that as well, and loads of other music too. So I was used to hearing it a lot. I noticed that there was something going on with him and his friends. As a younger sister, watching my older brother and his friends who were older, but also trying to find some kind of escape in music through being in a band and trying to create some kind of identity. And sort of being quite impressionable at that age, they would often try to influence me on my music choices. And so kind of two things kind of happened in parallel, where I witnessed something about identity going on with young guys, and the connection to music from then. But also what had happened to me is my own experience of how music was impacting me emotionally. So I hope it's okay to like jump straight in with like an example, because it's
Absolutely.
Kind of linked. Yeah. So if I think back to, say, I think it was 1995. Yes. It would have been Glastonbury 1995. I would have obviously been way too young to go to any gigs or festivals, but it was always on the TV. I remember that summer was really hot, and it was June, and it was on the TV. And it was that summer that Oasis played on, I think it was it the main stage. I can't remember which stage they played on, but what was happening for me around that time is my grandmother was very unwell. So me and my brother were often going to the hospital to visit her. It's a little bit of a sad story, because she was very poorly and she was dying. But what had happened is there was a kind of coinciding between me being in the hospital and feeling very, very low, and kind of watching my grandmother in the ward and looking at the ward and feeling kind of like, this place is quite a miserable place. And the waiting room was quite sort of sad looking room. And my brother obviously sensed I was a bit low, and he said, why don't you come into the waiting room? Like, they're playing Glastonbury on the screen now. So at that point, I went in this waiting room, and there was just this tiny little video, like, it was one of those old televisions in the top right hand corner. It was very fuzzy, but it was just at the point where they were playing footage of Oasis playing Live Forever. And in that moment, I looked up and there was a picture. Well, it was the image of Liam's face, just his face in the microphone with a tambourine around his neck. And I remember thinking, this man looks extraordinary. I don't know what it was, but it was something about the way he had the tambourine around his neck and he was singing, I Want to Live Forever. And it was the juxtaposition of hearing him sing, I Want to Live Forever, whilst knowing my grandma was dying, that made me realize, oh, there's another world out there. There's something out there that I'm not privy to, and I'm sad in here. And life isn't all about death and sadness and despair. I was thinking, I was only like 12, 13, thinking, is this the point of life, just being sad and old? But actually here was Liam singing, I don't want to live, I don't want to die, I want to live forever. And it triggered something. It was like a light bulb switch. And there was something in that that impacted me around music and what that did to me emotionally. So it was a combination of that experience, becoming a music fan, and watching my brother and what was going on for them, which then kind of cemented these two threads of interest in both how music impacts emotionally, but also the music industry and what being in a band gives, I guess, people, what the kind of identity it gives them and what goes on in the music industry as well. And then when I got older, I started writing a lot more and I was writing about music. And then I noticed something quite dark around every time I spoke to musicians, I noticed there would be these stories that would come out, these stories of like excess and rock and roll. And there'd be like something told to me, like as if it was a funny story, like, oh, I got completely smashed and this happened and this happened and so and so. But there would always be something tragic at the heart of the story. Someone was ill, someone's died, someone's so quite horrible vision, like images. I remember thinking, this isn't funny, this isn't rock and roll, this isn't whatever it's being packaged as. All I felt was, this is incredibly sad. So there was that thread that then joined as well. And after I became a therapist, I kind of just wanted to combine all those threads together to give me the idea that I wanted to do a podcast combining these two themes. If I was now a therapist and I wanted to look at the mental health impact of music and also look at the mental health within the industry and combine the two things together.
And it's two conflicting things, I guess, isn't it? I mean, you're saying that on the one hand, being a music fan, someone who listens to music, is largely a positive thing for your mental health because it opens up a different perspective on life and triggers different, largely positive emotions. But in terms of the people who are making this music that brings joy to so many of us, they're having to sort of often go through hell to do it. I mean, I've written before, though, about this sort of what I perceive as the false kind of connection between hedonism and creativity, and this idea that, any great rock and roll star or talent needs to be troubled, needs to have that kind of hedonistic way about them. You need to be Jim Morrison or Keith Richards to be great. What's your point of view on that? Is there a connection between pain, hedonism, and good creativity?
I think it's such a dangerous narrative, and it's something that is quite well understood now, I think, within therapeutic circles, that making those kinds of connections is quite unhelpful for the people who are in creative industries, but also it kind of overlooks the issue of things like hedonism and addiction in other aspects of the world as well. So, what do I mean by that? I guess that there's two things to that, because if you if you start to create a connection between suffering and creativity, you get a scenario where you have all these things like the 27 Club, and you have this sort of romanticizing of death and suffering, and it can put someone in a creative role into this belief that that's that they need to suffer for their art and that idea, which can be destructive for them. So if they have a destructive streak, they're going to feel that that needs to be fueled. Or if they don't have a destructive streak, they might feel that they need to somehow create one in order to be a better artist. And we understand, there is quite a strong connection and link between, and this is something I'm happy to go into as well, between things like suicidal ideation, that there is a strong contagion effect that has been researched and understood around how people can sort of copycat suicidal behavior. So when you're looking at these ideas of like the 27 Club with Kurt Cobain, and with even down to people like Amy Winehouse, or like you said, Jim Morrison, there can be an emulation of that behavior. So it can be quite a dangerous narrative to perpetuate, and it can have real repercussions. And what I'd also say is, actually, when you look at the numbers of people who suffer, there are plenty of people who are not creative at all, who also take their own lives. People who are alcoholics and addicted to drugs, who don't have any creativity at all. There's plenty of people who work at in supermarkets and or in banks, or lawyers who suffer these issues. So to kind of directly put a link between these two things as intrinsically connected, I think is quite is a way of overlooking the bigger picture. But that's not to say that there aren't aspects of how the industries work that can kind of influence kind of predispositions to mental health problems that can exacerbate that kind of thinking as well. So it's quite complex, but I'm quite cautious around kind of perpetuating that myth. And I think probably that has probably been said to you before in other interviews as well. I know that other therapists say similar things. I don't know if you agree with that or not. I don't know.
I agree. I
What do
agree, and I but I can see it from both sides. And today,
you
sitting here now, I agree with you, and I've thought this for a while, and I really think it's unhealthy, the kind of portrayal of, sort of pretty depressing kind of hedonistic like behaviors that are usually miserable for the person who's living through it, as romanticized or as like almost evidence of being like a sort of a glamorously flawed individual. So, but I also know the other side. I know that when I was drinking and taking drugs, in a way, it's one of the many things that contributes to it. It's one of the many things that stops you feeling like you need to make a change, because you can tell yourself, oh, well, I do creative things. Or even I can imagine if you didn't do anything creative, if you were a bloody accountant and, and you were, developed a drink or drug taking problem, perhaps because of the rock and roll connotations of that, it might make you feel, well, this is good because it means that I'm more than just an accountant. I'm living something that's slightly more edgy and sexy, or whatever. And I think all of those things are really dangerous. It's a big cultural force that contributes to people very often falling into pretty miserable ways of living. I think it definitely played a role in mine, probably. So yeah, I totally agree with you. That said, some people have said to me, some even professional people have said to me over the years, well, of course, I mean, if we take the hedonism out of it, if we take drinking and drugs out of it, they have said without the anxiety and the sort of, volatility of your mental health and your emotions, perhaps you would be less driven and less creative. I don't know if that's something that you've heard and whether you agree with it.
I have heard it and I can see where that's coming from, because I think if you've been through a period of suffering, what can often happen is, like, through your way of processing it, you can process in quite creative ways. So people can become quite poetic in moments of despair, because I guess what's happening is you're losing your verbal dexterity when you're in an experience of, when you've experienced trauma or you're in an experience of low mood, words don't necessarily come to you. You know, the ability to articulate isn't as easy always. And especially if you're having a trauma response and you're desensitized, your body's kind of shut down. Your access to that goes, but what doesn't go is your visual, metaphor, imagery. That comes to you and is more accessible to you. So it would make sense that in a period of suffering, you become creatively attuned to imagery, metaphor, words, poetry, which makes sense, music as well, music, art, dance, all of those things. And that's kind of why, you may already know this, I don't want to say anything you don't already know, but, like, you have different kinds of therapy, and a lot of people don't know that there's things like music therapy, art therapy, drama therapy, and those kinds of creative psychotherapies are actually very powerful for people who, for whatever reason, don't have access to verbal, what's the word? They can't verbalize clearly. So that could be because maybe you're autistic, it could be because you're going through psychosis, it could be a neurological issue, you might have had an accident, and maybe someone in that position can't articulate with words what's happening for them, but they can sit with a music therapist, and the music therapist can play a piece of music, and the person can respond emotionally to it with music, and likewise with art, and all sorts of things can come out that can then be explored together without needing words. And that's kind of how those arts therapies operate. But if you kind of map that onto the idea of creativity, even outside of the therapy space, you can quickly understand how people can sort of turn to those outlets much more easily in moments of trauma and anxiety, depression, any kind of mental health issue, sadness, despair, any big emotions like grief, and make it into art. So there is merit in saying, it is common that people can become creative through their suffering. But I think the thing there is, it's about process. So the suffering has happened, and then you're processing it through art. But that's very different to being in a position of acute despair where nothing creative is accessible in that moment. And I think they're quite different things, that you don't have to have one to access the other, even if one can help the other sometimes as well.
For me, a big turning point for my mental health was the point about 5 years ago when I made a decision to give up listening to all talk radio and replace it entirely with music. I'd always been a music fan, but I needed more and more the reminder that music gives me about, a bit like what you said at the beginning, a different life, a different world. Really, great music is sort of an expression about being human and all the sort of universal feelings and experiences. And the things that tended to get me down were the other stuff that didn't feel particularly naturally human, to do with just the mad, busy, working kind of life, whether it was whether I was listening to a radio where there was terrible stories about politics, or the environment or even sport. I couldn't handle it. It was just too much stimulus and too much fuel for my anxiety. And listening to stuff that was just about the experience of being human, good or bad, felt much more grounding. That said, there was a period in my life, probably about 12 years ago, before I got sober, but also before my drinking got out of hand. It was just my first taste of really of what I would now reflect on as a mental health crisis. And the reason I thought of it as a crisis was that it got the point for me where I thought, okay, this is really serious. And it was the first time I went to see a therapist, is I stopped being able to listen to music. I just was completely unable to. I couldn't listen to any song without the lyrics. If it was a song with lyrics, which most of the music I listened to was, without the lyrics somehow being twisted into something dreadful and anxiety triggering, no matter what the song was about. And so then I thought, I'm gonna try and listen to music without lyrics. And then even the melody would sort of almost, even if you were listening to the most upbeat melody in the world, it would somehow become mournful. I found that terrifying, because now looking back today, it's the one thing that I can always turn to that will probably lift my mood or soothe me at least, you know. And I remember that was one of the first things I said to the first therapist I ever saw. And he said to me, "Why are you here?" And I said, "Well, you know, I just, my mind is locked 100% of the time into worry, anxiety and fear. And from the moment I wake up to the moment I sleep, that's all that's going on. And nothing I can do to distract it." And he said, "Well, give me an example." I said, "Well, I've listened to music my whole life. I'm mad passionate about music, but I cannot listen to music. It terrifies me. I was actually terrified of music." And that is something that, and I suppose when I look back on that, it makes me feel so much better today, because the difference between how I was then, how I'm now, is that the reverse is true. If I'm having a little bit of a bad moment or a bad day, I can always soothe myself by choosing the right music. I'm just interested, really, in your work as a psychotherapist. Have you ever heard of something like that? Can people's relationship with music be both good and bad?
I've heard it often, but I have sometimes heard it. I mean, it's common to lose interest in things that you might ordinarily love. That is common. Yeah. I mean, I want to make sure I answer that question properly, because I'm just thinking about how that might have been for you, that there's a kind of, like, I don't know if there's a kind of hypersensitivity in that moment, because you said in that moment you were feeling so anxious that listening to the music was making you feel especially mournful, or it was like too much. There was a too muchness to it. Is that what you meant? It was too much.
Yeah.
Yeah. That, I think, is something that does come up in the therapy room a lot, this too muchness. So not necessarily in relation to music, but just sort of a kind of obliteration of the senses, kind of, you know, sight, sound, noise, sensitivity to things can be too much. So I think, I mean, that makes sense to me. There's a kind of shutting down, like you would have been potentially like in a hypervigilance. I might think about that a bit more, because I might give that a bit of thought and come back, because I don't know that I want to make sure I give a proper answer to that.
Well, listen, you know, I'm not trying to put you on the spot. I'm certainly not trying to seek kind of a bit of cheeky free therapy you while I've got you here. It's something that popped into my head while I'm thinking about the influence music has on me. And I'm just grateful that, you know, nowadays I can use it in the exact reverse way. You've talked to us about, you know, how your mind was open to the power of music and the effect it could have. What about your route into psychotherapy? What led you down that road?
So that road was slightly less clear initially. So I would say that probably the roots of it, like noticing that I was someone who was quite sensitive and like people would come to quite often and share things with, was always there from a young age. But for me, something around the age of 17 kind of solidified it a bit more, because I had a friend at school who out of the blue, and it was completely out of the blue, had attempted suicide. And I remember at that age feeling I just was quite shocked, because what I remember is that she was, for all intents and purposes, someone I experienced as probably one of the most vibrant and happy and positive thinking people I knew. And so that news really took me by surprise, and I think it flipped everything on its head. So from that moment on, I didn't really take anything at face value. I just kind of thought, all the people around me, whatever I'm seeing isn't the actual picture. So from then on, anytime I spoke to anyone, I was kind of almost hyper attuned to what wasn't being said. So if someone said anything to me, like you know, they recently moved country and they're living on their own or something like that, even something as simple as that, or they've changed jobs, I wouldn't be thinking, oh great, they've changed jobs, how exciting. I'd be thinking, oh, I wonder how that is for them. They've changed jobs, they might be in a state of flux, or they're living on their own. I wonder what support they have. I might just check in on that later. I started to kind of think more along that lines. And then what then happened is I was studying at the time, and I was at university, and I went abroad to study in France. And I got triggered into this kind of acute period of anxiety. And that anxiety led me to contact support, which I couldn't find because I was in another country and there was like a language barrier. So I kind of went down this rabbit hole of trying to access support. And this was like 2003. So there wasn't anything out there. The internet was really sparse. There was, you know, there was no Google, I don't think, at that time. I think it was like Ask Jeeves. I think it was around that time. I couldn't find any information anywhere. But there was a kind of fortuitous email that arrived because my university was affiliated. It was affiliated to the Institute of Psychiatry, because there's lots of different colleges that were part of my university. And they would often send, the Institute of Psychiatry would often send through emails asking for participants to take part in various bits of research. And on this particular day, there was an email saying, have a look at this questionnaire. If this relates to you, let us know if you want to be a volunteer. And when I looked at the questions on the questionnaire, every single question related to what I was feeling. And it was like, oh my God, this is exactly my experience. And I replied back with a stream of conscience. And the person that replied was really kind and sort of said, you know, this is more common than you think. And basically, to cut a long story short, that kind of set me on a trajectory to initially thinking I wanted to, I didn't want anyone to feel the way I had felt. I wanted to somehow pay that back. That was the initial sense. And it started with me thinking about working on a helpline. And that's when I became, at that point, I became interested in Samaritans. So it took a few years before I actually sort of took the plunge and wanted to train to become a Samaritan. But I thought rather than actually jumping straight in and training as a therapist, I wanted to understand that I could do the work that I wouldn't feel too impacted by hearing difficult material. So I thought doing a helpline would help me get more of a sense of what that does to me. So I did that first, and after about 4 years, I realized I did it for 4 years and realized actually this is really what I want to do. And that's what made me make the decision to actually go ahead and train properly as a therapist.
And how's that been for you? Is it, you know, because it sounds to me that the fact that you were, when you describe yourself younger and being kind of, you know, very attentive of what people's, you know, what people might have going on under. So that must have been very exhausting and stressful for you. So does training professionally to understand people, has that alleviated that a bit for you personally, as well as helping others?
Yeah, actually, it helped massively because what it did is it put a boundary around it. It sort of took something that was like, I don't know what you would call it, like a, if you call it a skill or an aptitude, I don't know what you would want to call it, like an ability to do something, but it was uncontained. And it was when I was young, I wouldn't have the ability to sort of switch off and say no. So I could be on the phone for hours and hours with someone trying to support them, or and it was I didn't have the best boundary. So what was happening in my as I developed it into a career, I learned how to take it and make it more productive by putting clear boundaries around it, knowing that I can actually reach more people that way anyway, and also look after myself as well and do it in a contained way. Gave me huge skills, and I would say that was probably one of a huge value of doing this. I know you're training as a therapist as well, so I don't know if you find it as
I'm
well,
not.
but I don't
I'm
know. Oh,
not.
you're not on.
Well, I've done my level two. I've
You're
completed my level two.
done.
So I'm not. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Cool. Well, I mean, you might identify with bits of it because, I found that it completely got rid of any sense of bleeding into my own life. So, I can hold a lot now. I'm quite surprised at how much I can take and hold without it getting without it in. Going to use this word, sort of. I don't want to use language that's too clinical, but without it bleeding into my own life, I can hold the two things side by side quite strongly, and I feel quite confident with that now. And I can hear a lot without getting sad. It's not about me, and I can be alongside another person, and I can hold my boundaries and live my own life and be able to do that quite well now. And I'd say the training does help with that a lot. It took time, but it works.
And I guess you have to be under supervision as well from your own therapist, which must support you in that sense too, right? Is that one of the reasons why you have supervision in order to like cope with maybe some of the stuff that you're hearing from clients seep into your own life?
Kind of. So, for anyone who doesn't know, like all therapists are kind of obliged to, or they should have regular supervision as part of their practice. So all that means is that you have your client base, but at least once a week, you also see a supervisor who you talk through your caseload with. And your supervisors always kind of, their back is with your client so that they're making sure that you're supporting your client appropriately. But at the same time, they're making sure that you are also feeling okay, as you said, because you might be affected by what you're hearing. And it's just a place to explore that. But it's also a place where you can work through something. If a client is bringing something that triggers you in some way, something in your own history, rather than it being played out in the therapy room, you could take it to to the supervision setting and work it through there. As sometimes really useful things come out in that situation that you hadn't considered that you can then take back into the therapy with the client that you can use to help them support themselves in a different way. So it's kind of that, it serves that dual function. It's both for you, but it's also to make sure you're being as present with your client as possible that you can be, so that you're not affecting your client. Your supervisor's really on the side of the client, if
Right,
anything.
I see. What about the role that music plays in your life personally? You know, you told us a bit about that kind of awakening moment in your teens. What about today?
It's a huge part of my life. I mean, I don't think I'll ever, I think it's the same for a lot of people, that when you find that band as a teenager that you love, nothing will ever quite reach that, because it's like there's a certain age in your life where you are impacted by music and it changes everything for you. It changes your whole world. And a lot of that is, I mean, there's a lot of research around that as well, which some people I've spoken to, academics who talk about this thing around age 14. There's this thing called the reminiscence gap.
Right.
The woman who researched that, her name is Kelly. I hope I say her name right, Kelly Jakubowski. She has researched this thing called the reminiscence gap, which is identified at age 14. Sorry, the reminiscence bump, which is where your memories are most acute, and it's the time when you come into contact with, cultural things like music at that time of your life, and that's why the memories are so acute then. So I would say nothing has ever come close to that experience, but I definitely listen to music now. I still love Oasis. I'm not ashamed to say it. I still love Oasis. I always find comfort in listening to that music. But it's not just that. I'm not just an Oasis fan. I love loads of different types of music, and depending on what kind of mood I'm in, there'll always be something to help me. And I think what I think of music is it almost is like a therapist, in the sense that it will reflect back at you what you're feeling. So if I'm feeling sad and I put on a sad song, it's like someone saying, "Oh yeah, this is how you feel," and me going and me saying, "Yeah, this is how I feel. You understand me." So there's kind of comfort in that. So I'm listening to it all the time. I'm in to kind of let go and let loose, as well as to like emotionally attune to it. It helps me when I'm working, if I'm writing and I need to listen to something to get me into like the flow of it. It helps me. Yeah, just my words are escaping me today, because a little bit, because I'm a little bit tired. I had an early morning, so sorry if I'm a bit slow.
No, you're very lucid to me.
I was just thinking what I was saying there about music being, it's kind of like alongside me. It sort of gets me into a state of mind where, if I'm frozen, for example, like sometimes if I feel a bit overwhelmed, I find that putting on certain songs can get rid of that completely. It can just get me into a more productive mindset. It helps me if I'm like doing something really boring, like the laundry or the dishes. Having music on just makes it more bearable. Started listening to podcasts actually. That helps as
Right.
well. There's something
Yeah.
similar going on there. It's like auditory experience that takes me out of the thinking into my body. And I think that's the thing when you're connecting it to what's kind of happening. I guess all of this, it's taking you out of your head into your body. It's connecting you to your senses and putting you in the here and now. And that's what I think is lending itself to this feeling of feeling alive and feeling awake. So it's very, very powerful.
And what's your, just lastly, what's your viewpoint on life as a musician? The guys who the men and women who make this amazing stuff that has such a powerful impact on us. I know you've spoken to a lot of fantastic musicians on your podcast. Are there themes emerging for you about the life of a musician and the factors affecting their mental health?
There's loads of issues there. I mean, there's lots of research going on in that area, and I'm sure you've heard of a lot of it as well. And but what I would say there is that there's kind of two things going on, because the thing that brings people to become a musician, depending on what style of music we're talking about, but there's what brings people to that career. There's what music does to them and how it influences them and changes them. It's how music for them, the actual playing of music, what that does for them, emotionally, therapeutically. And all of that is a totally different experience to what the job of being in that industry is, which is something else, which is like it's got a whole load of, the whole system of being, the music industry system is set up in a way, and it is changing, thankfully, but it has been historically set up in a way that if you have any kind of childhood, I guess, if you're predisposed to a mental health issue, or you've been through any kind of trauma as a child or anything like that, or even in later life, when you look at the kind of conditions of the music industry, if you put someone in that environment, a lot of those things can get triggered, and then you kind of they're exacerbated by like touring schedules and lack of sleep and the pressure to keep performing and keep producing and getting reviews that are bad, or having to maintain a presence on social media. All of that has an impact on your well-being anyway. But if you're predisposed somewhat to something, it will get triggered. So I would say what I'm seeing is these two things side by side, that there's something that being in that world gives in terms of identity and belonging, and at the same time it comes with these kinds of side effects or repercussions as a result of being in that world, which thankfully now are being much betterly, that's not a word, much better addressed, betterly addressed. Because I don't know if you've heard of Tamsin Embleton. She's just produced a book which is specific to this, to that topic. It's the music industry. It's got a long title. The title escapes me right now. The Music Industry Manual, Music and Mental Health, Music Industry Manual. It's for musicians on tour. It goes into all of that, and it's a really fantastic book. I really recommend it if anyone is interested in looking at the academic side of what research is going on behind the scenes in that area. But I'm finding that there's two strands to it, and I'm finding it all fascinating, because it's linked to I think what I personally enjoy is hearing the psychology of it all, and the sense of belonging and identity that people get or talk about in why they went down that road. That's what really interests me. I hope that's I hope that's answered it.
It has. And you know, you've covered so much fascinating ground, and I really appreciate you spending time to talk to me, because it is a fascinating subject. You speak about it really, really interestingly, both here today and also on your podcast, which I can highly recommend to my listeners, Sound Effects, which is available throughout all the usual channels. And just before I let you go, you've also got a couple of fantastic books which are available, which we haven't had a chance to talk about, but which I will include links to in the show notes. Just tell us what they're called before we let you go, and then and people can link and with any luck buy them.
Sure, thank you. One is called How to Understand and Deal with Stress.
Yeah.
And the other is Your Mind Matters, How to Talk About Your Mental Health. So the one about stress is kind of how to help you identify that you're feeling stressed. I think because this is something I've noticed in your previous podcast episodes that I've listened to, people talk a lot about that moment of crisis, and you often talk with them about that before period of how to identify that things are not quite okay. And I guess within my book, I kind of talk about that before stuff, like how to identify that you're like how to know that you're likely to be stressed, even if you're not consciously aware of
yeah,
it just yet.
Totally. That you're totally, yeah. I mean, I 100% think that's so important. It would have been so important to me. I didn't have that ability. I wouldn't allow myself to acknowledge the existence of stress until it was, you know, late in the game and I hit a crisis. And that seems to be so reoccurring, so particularly so many blokes who aren't perhaps as emotionally aware, you know, which I certainly wasn't. So that's a fantastic subject, I think.
Thank you. Yeah. And the other one, How to Talk About Your Mental Health, that's more around like if you start to feel that you have got some, you're starting to identify that maybe there's a problem, but you don't quite know what the problem is and you don't quite know how to articulate it or whether it's actually a thing or whether it, you know, what it is. It's just helping you. It gives you a very basic overview of what some of the different mental health issues are and what they might look like, but it also helps to give you some language around it, that if you think you're feeling something and you want to express it, it gives you a bit of a language of how to approach someone with it, what to say, and whether that's a friend or a doctor, a helpline, and it kind of explains the different avenues that you can look for. So if you don't want clinical support, I kind of explain what you can do, but if you do want clinical support, I explain like how you access it, and it's just helping you kind of navigate it a bit in that way. But it also gives a few tips to people who are on the receiving end, so anyone who is supporting someone with an issue. If someone comes to them and says, I'm experiencing this, it gives them a few tips for how to hear it and listen to it, and so that they feel empowered to know what to do as well.
Well, they both sound like fantastic books. I'll certainly be investigating them both. Katerina, thank you ever so much for joining me today on The Reset. It's been a real pleasure meeting you, and let's stay in touch. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Sam.
That was Katie Giorgio. I'd love to hear from you about your relationship with music and specifically the role it plays in your mental health. You can always get in touch with me via samdelaney.substack.com, where you can join chats with other subscribers and also get access to bonus podcasts and newsletters. That's it for this week. Thanks, Katie, for being a great guest. Search for her podcast, Sound Effects. That's effects with an A, wherever you get your pods, and check it out. Thanks, as always, for listening, gang. Until next time. Be lucky and don't let the dickheads get you down.